everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can catch us on restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Very well. How are you?
Feeling a little bitter.
I am not feeling bitter. I'm feeling great.
Actually, it was my little lead-in, my little jokey lead-in to the topic of our little get-to-know-you talk this morning. There was an article in the Chicago Tribune recently about bitters, and I thought it was a pretty good one. And I think that there's an interesting history to bitters. And, you know, bitters are really important in cocktails, and they're everywhere now.
I think, frankly, the word bitter is one of those words that people are a little bit afraid of, a little more afraid of than they should be. And what they don't realize is that the bitters in your cocktail are really an aromatic. That's really the most important reason a bitter is in your cocktail, is for what it smells like and how it changes the aromas in your cocktail.
You know, and it's funny. Bitters are also like an inexplicable... they're not inexplicable, but they are surprising in how they affect drinks.
You seem to be having problems explicating them.
Just because I have trouble explaining them does not mean they're inexplicable. The thing about bitters is they're magical. I mean, you have a drink that's wrong, and you hit it with a little bit of bitters, and very often you're like, oh, there it is. It all comes together now.
Well, as people who make a lot of drinks, as Francis and I do, and create a lot of drinks, as Francis and I do, what you realize with the bitters is it's another tool in your arsenal.
Yep,
it's like having a whole new set of types of spirits that you never had before to use and to finish drinks, and to, you know, there are 50, 100 different bitters that you can use now in a cocktail, that and each one changes the drink differently.
And, you know, bitters, non-potable bitters are something that you hit with, like, you know, two little drops of it, mm-hmm. and it really works. There's an Joe Fee, who is the fourth generation operator of Fee Brothers, which is a bitters company from Rochester. He said something I thought was really interesting and goes a long way to explaining how adding bitters to a cocktail works. He says, you know, in crafting dishes, you want to hit all of the taste receptors most mm-hmm. of the time. So you've got salty, sweet, sour, and bitter. And if you don't hit the bitter note, and often in beverages you don't have something that's bitter unless you purposefully have gone to look for it, the drink just doesn't feel, it's not the same experience because you're not firing on all four cylinders. And you know, that was really insightful.
Yeah, I thought that was really well done. Actually, at the end of the article, the author makes an analogy between bitters in cocktails and vanilla in baking. And I thought that was also really, really insightful.
Because vanilla is universal.
Because vanilla is universal, and everybody understands vanilla, and everybody realizes that if you bake even a little bit, think about what your chocolate chip cookies would be without vanilla.
Well, think about what your chocolate would be without vanilla.
Exactly.
I mean, most people realize, but, you know, vanilla is one of the ingredients in chocolate, mm-hmm. in a chocolate candy. The other thing about bitters that is, well, let's clarify for our guests exactly what bitters are. We have two types of bitters that are available to you behind a bar or in the beverage business. There's potable bitters and non-potable bitters. Potable bitters are a bitter that you would buy in a liquor store, and you would drink as a digestive after dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So Chinar is a bitter.
Amaro. The whole
Amaro.
Family of Amaros.
Well, the Italian word Amaro mm-hmm. translates as bitter. So you have the bitters that you would drink after dinner. Averna, Montenegro. Mm-hmm. And those are
Puntimes,
cocktails. Puntimes is a vermouth. That's also a bitter. Mm-hmm. So those are potable bitters. Non-potable bitters are a unique category because the bitter itself is unpalatable. It's so unpalatable that even though it has a large percentage of alcohol, like cooking wine, you can buy it in a supermarket in most states.
But if you put a dash of Angostura bitters on your tongue, you would just be disgusted
right.
by it.
If you drank a glass of Angostura bitters, you'd be unhappy.
Yes.
Well, and, you know, with a lot of the bitters that have come out recently, the government sort of regulates what's a potable bitter and what's a non-potable bitter, and a non-potable bitter is a lot easier to sell because it's treated like a supermarket item. And just so you know, cooking wine
can be purchased anywhere.
Well, and cooking wine, one of the ways that they qualify wine as cooking wine is it's salted. So you're quote unquote cooking, and I never cook with cooking wine. It doesn't become cooking wine until I put it in the pan.
It's non-cooking wine.
So I was inspired by Julia Child, who I'm sure took nips of
If you store it above the oven, don't cook with it.
Right. Throw it away.
That's all the information you need.
But so the non-potable bitters is very important. And Angostura is the most popular bitters company. And while there had orange bitters was the second most popular kind of bitters you would find out, and for a while the most popular bitters in the world prior to Prohibition. And Angostura bitters, there's a company called Angostura. They make their bitters from the bark of the Angostura bark. So there are aromatic cocktail bitters made by other companies, which are also made from Angostura bark.
Correct.
Angostura owns that name. And the only two bitters that were available in the American market for the first 20 years we were bartending.
As long as I can remember.
Was Angostura Bitters, the company Angostura Bitters, mm-hmm. and Peychaud's
right.
from New Orleans. They're Point of Pride, New
but
Orleans.
But Peychaud, even to find Peychaud Bitters in a bar until 5 years ago was
right. We were real
almost
cocktail
impossible.
Geeks because
right.
we had Peychaud Bitters. And mm-hmm. we had to, like, you know, you pull strings to get them.
And our Angostura Bitters weren't 25 years old right. and disgusting.
Well, what happened was now you have all of these bitters. A lot of bars are making their own bitters, sometimes with success, sometimes with limited success. But what you have now with all these bitters, you had the – of course, there's a cocktail renaissance, and cocktailians and people who mix drinks, they're really looking for the old styles of bitters to come back and then making their own. Gary Regan, a friend of ours – was the first to come out with an orange bitters, Regan's orange bitters. We still have behind our bar. It's phenomenal. And then Fee Brothers came out with bitters. But do you know what really gave a big push to this whole locomotion? Now, remember, Angostura was the bitters. If you mm-hmm. ordered something with bitters in it for 40 years.
No, you got Angostura. At any bar, frankly, I ever worked in before I owned my own.
Just as this was about to pop, as the cocktail revolution was running, and at a fever pitch, the Angostura company had a dispute with its bottle supplier, and there was a shortage. And this was like real. We hoarded some Angostura bitters. Everybody hoarded Angostura bitters. What a foolish move!
It was terrible because they invited every other competitor to come into the marketplace and take a foothold.
And there are now hundreds and thousands of bitters that you can buy, and they're really interesting.
Yeah, I mean there are. I'm going to say 50 to 100 behind our bar, and we don't have anywhere near all the types of bitters. I mean, we have a representative sample of the ones we want to use in our cocktails, but we don't have anywhere near all the bitters that are available in the world, and people are making their own. People are making their own behind their own bar all the time. You know, I want this essence in this particular cocktail.
Right.
I'm going to be honest. I don't know that I see the need for that anymore.
As
there are so many different possibilities for bitters out there. You know, there's more than one celery bitters that you can buy.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny.
How often do I need celery bitters?
Well, and the thing about bitters is, you know, the absolute subtlety and nuance among bitters. I mean, it's not like a bottle of wine. You know, I don't think there's that. Yes, I think it's important to go from bitter to bitter. You need celery bitters in this cocktail. But you know what? If you think about it, the main bitters now for orange bitters that are out there, you've got Angostura has come out with
Angostura orange, which we use and is distinctive.
And Gary Regan's bitters and Fee Brothers bitters. They're all very different, but some of them are too much. Angostura orange bitters, we don't use that in a single cocktail anymore. One mm-hmm. drop of that, it makes the whole thing taste
That's
like a
the
tangerine.
Problem. What we really need to do with the Angostura is come up with a way to put a half a drop.
Yeah. It's just too much.
We need a half a dropper.
It's not possible for me to – every time I put that in a drink, it takes it over.
It takes it over. Well, you have to have – it's got to have the right drink for to
here,
use that
Here
Angostura.
Are a couple of cool things that we do with bitters. Bitters we use on the top of a drink, but we have Chris behind our bar has been – flaming the bitters. You can run the bitters. We take bitters and overproof rum and put it in bitters and grain alcohol, and we put them in a little sprayer, and we spray them over a match, and it sort of roasts the bitters as they hit the top of the.
Yeah.
Oh my God!
It's
so
very,
good.
It's very much like that old trick with the orange peel, where you light the orange oil on fire as it goes into the drink. It really significantly changes the composition of what you're kind of putting into the drink by flaming it.
Before bitters became this widely popular, I remember We were out one night with Audrey Saunders, who owns the Pegu Club, who's a quite well-known cocktailian here in New York and around the country and around the world. And she's great. She's an old friend of ours. And she used to carry a bottle of bitters in her purse. She had this little eyedropper bottle of bitters in her purse. And she said, you know, you go to a restaurant, you want salt and pepper, they'll give you salt and pepper. You want bitters, they don't give you bitters. And I thought, well, you know, and she would, we'd go out and have a drink, and it'd be a pretty good drink, and she would fix many a drink with two drops of bitters from her purse.
Yeah.
So in line with that, and these guys are not a sponsor, though if they're listening, you want to send us a check, you may. There's the Bitter Truth Company is a, they make a lovely line of bitters. They have celery bitters, orange bitters, Creole bitters, old-time aromatic bitters, which are, and the best is the Jerry Thomas-owned decanter bitters, which are phenomenal. But they just came out with this really cool traveler pack. Now, these bitters are, they're considered, I don't think they're considered non-potable, though you would never want to drink them. They're definitely for dashing. So you need to buy, they're in a liquor license place, and they, but they came up with the traveler's set with little 10 centiliter bottles of six different bitters in a little box.
It's awesome.
How cool is that?
And you know, should be in any traveling bartender, anybody who's going to make cocktails someplace else should be carrying this little pack of bitters.
By the way, I bought a case of these to put behind the bar. If anyone's listening and wants to come to the bar and buy one, here, you know what really sold me, though? First of all, I think the package is cool. It looks all retro. I love that you can have them in your pocket. They're small, and they're in a box, so they're organized. 10 centiliters is small enough that you can carry it on the airplane.
On the airplane, exactly.
That's
awesome. Brilliant. It's brilliant.
Take my shampoo, leave my bitters. All right, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on restaurantguysradio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. And our guest today has written a book on a subject so near and dear to our hearts. Food Trucks, Dispatches from Recipes of the Best Kitchens on Wheels was written by Heather Schaus, and she joins us now.
Heather, welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
So we talked a little bit before you came on the show. I know we had a little banter back and forth about the food trucks here in New Brunswick, New Jersey, affectionately referred to by anyone who's been to Rutgers for any period of time and been drunk at 1 o'clock in the morning, as the all the food trucks are together on the Rutgers campus and they're right in the middle of downtown. They're called the Grease Trucks. And so why didn't the Grease Trucks make your book?
Just to upset you guys, basically. Just to start some smack here between Chicago and New Jersey.
Well, so you don't
know, really, you know, just to kind of reiterate what we were talking about, yeah, it's, the Grease Trucks are definitely legendary, and, you know, I think they definitely have a place, as you said, in probably most Rutgers students' heart, but, you know, I wouldn't really send somebody out of their way to go get them. It seems like they all have a very similar lineup. They all do the fat sandwiches. They all really live up to the name of being a grease truck, but I'm not sure that they would definitely qualify as one of the top 100 food trucks in the country, which is essentially what I tried to do, doing larger profiles on about 50 of them, but including and mentioning 100 of the trucks that I felt were hitting three real specific things, which is absolutely delicious food, original concept, and unique style of food, or a unique genre, and then third, they had to have an interesting story to tell, because I wanted the book to be more than just a travel guide. I wanted it to also be a kitchen companion and an armchair read for people who wonder who would absolutely choose this life on trucks, because it's not easy. It's not an easy job by any stretch.
No
offense against New Jersey. I love you guys. Maybe we'll do a little sidebar on the trucks in the next edition.
Well, as a guy whose fraternity was across the street from where all the grease trucks are docked, you are correct.
Yeah.
They are none of those things.
Right. They had to drive to you, Mark. That's what they. But that actually speaks to a very different thing about food trucks. Is food trucks were, you know, the catering truck that was just getting fuel to the workers in the factory, or the
right.
It would pull up to a place where people were. It was never food that you would go out of your way for. Yet the food trucks you write about have Facebook pages and updates of where they are, and people go find them.
And most of them don't serve tasty cake.
Yeah, exactly.
Most of them do not serve tasty cake. No, they don't. Yeah, you know, it was an interesting time. The impetus for the book really was just the explosion right now in food trucks. As you mentioned, this is definitely not a new phenomenon. And I really wanted the book to explain to people that Kogi did not invent the taco truck. You know, I think that people started reading about things like Kogi and, you know, the donut trucks and the cupcake trucks and all this in the media and thinking that this was a new thing. And I really wanted to show the old school and the new school and talk a little about the history of food trucks in America all the way, you know, if you want to go all the way back to the chuck wagons, the Wild West, through the 50s with the construction site style trucks in the military bases in Honolulu, and then the huge influx of Mexican-American trucks that we were seeing in the 70s all throughout California. And that has evolved into what we have now, which is basically, as you mentioned, because of social media, because of Facebook and Twitter and this excitement that people are feeling about going out and tracking something down and finding it for themselves.
Yeah,
it's really cool.
It's not just the excitement. They can actually, you can go on Twitter and follow these food trucks and know exactly where it is and when it's going to be close enough to you that you can go to it.
Right, right. And in some cities, that model is not so important. I mean, cities with thriving food truck scenes, such as Portland, the trucks don't move. Mm-hmm. They're essentially trailers or carts, and they're parked into what they call pods, and they group together. So you have a choice of 8 or 9 or 10 different carts in one little pod. So they might use Twitter to let people know about daily specials or a pop-up chef who's going to show up and do a cool dish or something like that. But in cities like L.A., it's absolutely essential. So they will definitely, you know, if you want, you can even go to an aggregator. Now they have food truck Twitter aggregators, and you can have them all fed right to your phone, and you can see where you are, and you can figure out, okay, who's near me, and I'm in the mood for Vietnamese or, you know, whatever. So it's kind of unreal how much technology has intersected with the food truck trend.
When did we first see really high quality food coming out of a food truck? Was it with the advent of social media?
Well, it depends. You know, high quality is such a relative term. I think that some of the Mexican trucks in LA are of the utmost quality. It's just that because of the way that we stereotype food in this country, if it's authentic and immigrant cooked, we look at it as cheap and ethnic. And that, for some reason, has a stereotype of being just different than if a classically trained chef or a, you know, badass chef like Roy Choi, who's all over Food and Wine magazine, if he decides to do a taco truck, then it's cool. You know, if these immigrants who've been doing it for 20 years do it, they could be doing the same caliber of food, but for some reason we don't respect it as much. So I think, you know, that the quality of food that you find on taco trucks in LA is unmatched. You're talking about people who have more competition than Charlie Trotter has competition. It's 7,000 taco trucks in LA, so if you can't stand out and you can't deliver delicious food to people that, and if they come to LA from your region, they are the authenticity police. If you're making wok and mole and it's not up to standard, you won't be in business anymore. So I think those trucks really have raised the bar for Mexican trucks around the country in LA. And then in terms of the concept trucks, the concept-driven trucks, the gourmet trucks, as people call them, that's probably about 2009, I would say, we started seeing. And Kogi really was, to give them credit, one of the first trucks that, excuse me, really nailed all of that. They had a great story. They had a great product. They were embracing social media. And they got people really excited about the idea of what was possible to be cooked on a truck.
You know, I don't completely understand. I see these great food trucks doing some great concepts, and you know, Portland, you give as an example.
Sure.
Why is the food in our food courts so pathetic, and yet we can in a mobile truck have these great and innovative ideas?
In a traditional food, you mean as in a mall food court?
Yeah.
Yeah, and all bad institutional food.
I mean, honestly, that would be corporate takeover. I mean, that's the thing. That's corporate domination of malls in America. You know, you're going to see the same Sbarro crap everywhere you go. So it's just, this is an independent spirit. And because they all work really well together and they have a community-minded entrepreneurial spirit, you're not going to see 6 pizza carts right next to each other because they know it's bad for business. So they organize with their with their, you know, colleagues in the food truck scene, and they say, okay, in this pod right here, we have an awesome crepe truck, so no more crepe trucks. You know, in this pod, we already have a really authentic Bangkok Thai truck, so let's get a Mexican truck, and let's get a Belgian fries truck. And they do a very good job of diversifying and sort of self-policing so that they don't cut each other off. And they also have really high standards, because these days with the internet, you guys know how powerful of a tool that is. And with Chowhound out there, and, you know, every person with a computer and a mouse has a blog almost now. So it's, you know, if you're not good, you're going to get railed online. And you, and so people, I think, are really striving hard in the food truck world to be as good as they can, or else they just won't make it.
You know, it's amazing to me to see this come out. I remember Mark and I were in Italy, it's several years back, not the last time, but the time before when we went to Italy, and there was a truck outside of this Verona where we were, we're at a wine conference, and we walked outside, and there was this truck, and it was a porchetta truck, and they had, you know, porchetta.
Oh, awesome.
I knew you were going to talk about that.
And I took a picture of that, and I had it as my screensaver for a while, the Italian food truck versus the grease trucks in New Brunswick. I got a picture of those. And I was like, and the subtext I had typed in was, they do it better. I meant life in general. And then, of course, food trucks have sort of arisen here since then.
Well, it's first you start with their pork has pig in it.
Yeah.
So that's
exactly
a good start.
One of the original pieces. Now,
but
you point out in your book that there's been a higher scrutiny, and there's not even regulation from city to city about, you know,
different regulation.
I'm sorry, there is uneven regulation from city to city, not that there's not even regulation. And what kind of role is that playing in the life of food trucks?
Well, I think it's interesting. I think it's the city halls and the overlying governing bodies that are seeing what's going on right now. They just don't even know how to keep up in a lot of cities, because it used to be mobile food vendors departments of the city halls would oversee maybe 10 or 12 hot dog trucks down in a touristy area, and now it's just exploding. I think that LA has had a little bit more experience with it, but even there, they're dealing with a lot of backlash from brick and mortars. So you're always going to have issues coming up. They just recently settled a dispute in LA by kind of appeasing the brick and mortar restaurants with this 200 feet law, which is, you know, the carts can't set up within 200 feet of the door of a restaurant or a bar that serves food. And that did a little bit to appease some of the guys who were complaining when, you know, a taco truck pulls up in front of a Chipotle or whatever.
Right.
So, you know, it's going to be different. But in Chicago right now, for instance, where I'm from, we're having a really crucial time with food trucks, because our city is home to the National Restaurant Association. It's the epicenter of food-related conventions. And a lot of powerful people in the food service industry on a large scale live and are based out of and work in Chicago. So it's going to be interesting to see how it works. But currently, you can't cook out of a truck in Chicago city limits. So Rahm Emanuel was just recently elected our mayor. So he has been really vocal about saying that he embraces the food truck model, and he wants to get Chicago up to speed with the other cities so that we can actually cook on trucks, which is 100% more delicious and 100% more sanitary, actually, because you're not keeping that food sitting there and it's warmer. Yeah. So, you know, it's going to just take a little bit of time, I think, as things shake out and as people in governing positions can figure out how to actually react to the huge numbers. You know, New York has done something that was probably pretty smart to kind of cap it. They capped the number of food truck permits a long time ago. But that also creates a black market, and it creates a huge obstacle. It's smart for the city because it's not going to get out of control. You're not going to see 7,000 trucks here. But at the same time, it creates a huge obstacle for people trying to open a truck. You have to go on Craigslist and find a black market license, because the lottery system is completely corrupt, and you're not going to be able to get a license legitimately in New York City for a truck. It's very difficult.
And expensive.
I shouldn't say you're not going to, but I'd say it depends on how much money you have and who you know, basically. So
well, we know how
it's different city to city.
We know how politics works in Chicago too, so we figure if you guys want to get something passed there, all you gotta do is hang out at the food truck, get a couple pictures of the politicians as they eat off of them.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Then,
well, you know, it's funny.
Send them, slip those pictures under their door.
You know, it's funny.
That's right.
You raise a great point, though. I mean, if you're a restaurant and you own a restaurant and the city is saying, okay, well, you own a restaurant, you have to be inspected like this, mm-hmm. you have to have a food license, and if you have a liquor license, you have to pay for the liquor license, and you have to
right.
abide by these ordinances. And if a food truck can pull up out front of your door and not have any of those expenses, I would
including real estate.
Right. I see the restaurant because you want a vibrant restaurant scene as well. I can see
right.
the restaurateur's point of view as well. I think that a balance needs to be struck.
It's not the same as pulling into a corporate center and where there's no restaurants
right.
or you know, in the old days they pull into a construction site and all the construction
right,
guys.
Right, but you know, I think that's a little bit of a misconception because, you know, the trucks do have a lot of expenses
mm-hmm.
and they do have licensing and they have to pay the same health inspection, same sanitary sanitation licenses, all of the same things that you would have to in a brick and mortar. You're right, they don't have the overhead of a mortgage or rent, but they do have to pay for somewhere to park their truck. They do have to pay for the truck to get started. You know, some of these trucks, I've seen people spend $200,000 on a truck, and it's an awesome four-star kitchen on wheels, but, you know, there is an absurd expense for these trucks, and then maintenance, and then propane,
yeah.
and gas.
I think there are certainly expenses, but I think that there has to be a balance.
There's got to be some regulation, I think, is what Francis said.
And like what you said before, if I own a hot dog store, two hot dog trucks should not be able to park outside my door
right.
and sell hot dogs, you
definitely.
Know, that for
yeah.
a penny cheaper. Well,
competition clauses, I think, are going to go a long way to kind of help mend the gap, I guess you could say, between the trucks and the brick and mortar restaurants, because I think that's really helpful. It's easier to get upset at somebody for their business model when they're parked right out front and it's directly affecting whether or not you can feed your family.
Exactly.
So, you know, I think those competitive clauses are definitely necessary. And at the same time, a lot of the big restaurant groups, though, that are complaining about it, in general, looking at it and saying, well, they don't have any overhead and they're going to do this. It's like, well, their food, what they're doing, is a completely different thing than what a lot of the majority of sit-down restaurants are doing. And it's not every diner out there. I mean, my parents are not going to go stand in line for an hour for a Korean taco and then eat it in the parking lot. They want to go sit down and have a nice bottle of wine. And, you know, I mean, it's a completely different dining experience. It's not going to completely cut into all of the regular business that a sit-down brick and mortar would have. But,
well, unless,
yeah, like you said.
Unless, of course, it's across from a Chipotle. Unless, of course, you know, they park
right.
in front of a Chipotle. You know.
Yeah, I think we're getting off topic here, and we should talk about how cool the foods that they are doing in these.
Yeah,
in
I want to. You know, we need to take a quick break, and I want to come back and talk about some of your favorite trucks. And my favorite is the big gay ice cream truck. I think that's my favorite
yeah.
my favorite truck of
yeah,
all.
Yeah.
But we'll be back in just a moment.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Heather Schaus. Her book is Food Truck: Dispatches and Recipes from the Best Kitchens on Wheels. You can find out more about it at restaurantguysradio.com. And we'll be back in just a moment. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. It's Mark Francis, and our guest is Heather Strauss. She's written a book on food trucks across America. And I think why this book is so special is we're not talking about the average what we call grease trucks here in New Brunswick on the corner, although they certainly have their place, and I am a patron and a supporter. These concept trucks, these high-end trucks that are making really good food and their own food. My favorite is the Big Gay Ice Cream Truck. How did that come about?
Well, actually, you know, he's a really interesting character, Doug. He's a classically trained bassoonist, which is pretty interesting, and he plays with the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra, and he just basically had an idea. He and his partner were talking about taking the old Tasty Freeze, Mr. Softy kind of trucks that you see all over New York City and Manhattan, and he said, wouldn't it be cool if we did something like that, but we did really funky ice cream, and we could name them after our favorite luminaries, and his favorite luminaries happened to be B. Arthur, you know? So he decided to kind of give it this shtick and really get the word out there that, you know, he's gay and he's proud, and he decided to do this truck, and he and his partner did it, and what they do is roll around and play really fun music and make really delicious Mr. Softy style soft serve ice cream, but then with gourmet toppings and dulce de leche and sea salt and wasabi peas and really funky stuff. And it's really fun. I think it opens up a lot of people's eyes. He goes in areas where there are a lot of tourists. And I asked him when I interviewed him, you know, did he ever have any issues with homophobia? And he says, you know, it's interesting because he will get a group of guys who maybe are in town from who knows where, but looking a little country, as he says. And they come up to the truck and they kind of make fun and they want their picture taken in front of it. But he talks to them and he kind of jokes back with them. And I think at the end of the day, they walk away from the experience. And they're like, that guy's actually pretty cool, you know. So he thinks in New York people are very open-minded, but hopefully he's helping just kind of show that there's a whole different side to the Mr. Softy trail, I guess.
Well, I have two comments. One is my favorite scene in a movie, and I can't that is coming to my mind. I can't remember the movie that it was in, but there was an unforgettable movie, and they're in a restaurant, and there's a gay guy. One of the characters is gay, and some guys in a restaurant are harassing him, and it winds up being a verbal altercation, and they say, you know what they should do with people like you? They should take all you gay guys and put you all on an island. And the guy says, honey, you're on it. So, but that and the old, I have to say, I haven't been there yet, but I've read great things via social media of the Big Gay Ice Cream Truck, because I had my first experience with a Mr. Softy a couple of years ago. I've had good humor, but I never had a Mr. Softy before. And it was incredibly it was incredibly disturbing to me, because it was a very hot day. I went up and I got myself a Mr. Softy, and I licked a little bit of this plasticky custardy thing, and it was 95 degrees out.
And it didn't melt.
It wasn't melting.
Yeah, they don't melt.
It wasn't melting. I was like, that's not ice cream. It doesn't even custard.
Yeah. I can't verify the ingredients. I'm sworn to secrecy on that one.
But is the ice cream delicious?
You know, it's really good. They use their own. It is literally a Mr. Softy truck, but you know, they use their own. They have the equipment in there, but they use their own soft serve concoction. They use their own recipe for the soft serve, and like I mentioned, they use their own toppings, and they use Nutella and dulce de leche and crushed salted cashews. And so they're doing a lot. I think with all that good stuff on it, you know, it's probably not going to make that huge of a difference if it's absolutely artisan style organic smell. You know, I'm not going to go that far and say it is, but it's really solid soft serve ice cream for sure.
So obviously not everybody who opens one of these trucks opens a Big Gay Ice Cream Truck. Is there a common thread among these people, among this type of entrepreneur? I mean, obviously they're entrepreneurs, but is there something else that kind of strings a lot of these people together?
The most successful ones, I would say, I noticed a theme throughout the country, is when you find one thing and you do it to the nth degree. That was the key, I think. And the trucks and carts and trailers I found that were least successful and were really trying to hang on, and they just couldn't figure out why it wasn't working, and maybe they had one or two items that were selling, I mean, that's a lesson, is you take those one or two items and you do it, and you make that your focus. You make that your concept, and you put it in your name, and you put it all over the side of your truck, and you let people know, this is what we do. So I think that is key to standing out, and that was really interesting to see a cart where a woman is from Bangkok, and she's in her late 20s, and she came to Portland. She wanted to do one dish, and it's based on her aunt's recipe for kalmanggai, which is chicken with rice. Sounds completely simple, but the way she does it is just, she takes so much care in every single element of that dish, and it shows. And so she sells out every single day. She parks downtown. She only does lunch, and every day she's sold out by 3 o'clock, and she finishes up and she goes home. And you know, there's a guy who does Belgian fries based on a tour that his rock band went to Belgium, and he saw this late night frites truck with these really cool, like, curried ketchup dipping sauces and stuff. So that's all he does off his truck. So I think finding that one thing, that niche, you know, that's what, again, Kogi, that's what they did. They were the first ones to really do Korean Mexican. And nobody had really thought about it before, but it makes so much sense because K-Town, the Korean area of L.A., is, you know, back-ended with the Latino population. So you have all this intermixing going on between Korean and Latino culture there. So it just made sense to do kimchi quesadillas and bulgogi tacos and combine these flavors that ultimately work deliciously together. So, yeah, that I think is something that I found the connective thread between the successful ones, for sure.
Well, Heather, we've got only a few minutes left, but I want to ask you two questions, rapid fire. Favorite food truck in New York, your number one food truck in New York and number one food truck in America. What's your response there?
Ooh. That one is so tough. In New York and in America. Let's see. So America, I mean, these guys, they have a truck. It's actually a trailer. It's called Eastside King. It's an awesome. And I think what they're doing is awesome. One guy's Filipino, one guy's Japanese. They work at a famous Japanese restaurant there called Uchi. And they decided to do their own trailer. And they're doing just really fun, awesome, pan-Asian street foods.
And where is this?
They do in Austin, Texas.
Okay.
And they just do delicious food. I mean, they have this one dish. They have these buns, these steamed buns like you would get. Momofuku made them famous, David Chang. But there are these folded over buns, and they soak them in this peanut curry sauce, and then they deep fry them, and they fill them with roasted pork belly that's just so tender and delicious. And then a little bit of a hoisin slaw with green scallions and cilantro. And so you have this fried, crunchy, peanutty, curry, delicious vehicle for this really fatty, yummy pork. It's awesome. And they serve it in the back of a bar called the Liberty. So they have all these picnic tables out there, and you can just get your food, sit at a picnic table, order a beer from the waitress, and you can actually enjoy it in an outdoor setting with a nice local, you know, Texas beer, and it's a really cool experience all around.
Actually salivating right now. I hope you're
happy.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, now for more local, because I'm not going to get to Texas soon, best food truck in New York City.
Okay. Well,
how about the one you're going to lunch to today if you're there?
I'm sitting in New York right now, so I'm thinking, like, who's going to get mad at me? You know, honestly, the carts, I think, here beat the trucks. As much as I like, you know, the trucks that are out there, most of the trucks in New York, in order to have the money to do it, are big deal. So, meaning they're coming from restaurants. They're an outshoot of a restaurant. It's the carts that really get me excited. I love NY Dosas. I think his dosas are delicious. He's from Sri Lanka. He parks on the West 4th and Sullivan Street, right there by Washington Square Park. And he is really popular with NYU students, but I think it's worth a trip. It's, you know, South Indian style dosas, but his flavors are delicious. And he does a coconut chutney. So the dosas are just so crispy on the outside, and you kind of dip them in to the chutney. There's a guy who's been forever in Chinatown, near Christie Street. It's this tiny little cart. I mean, this guy's in his 70s. He's from Hong Kong. He has this tiny little ghetto blaster where he plays classical music, and he sits behind this little waffle iron, and he makes what he calls all-natural hot mini cakes. But they're essentially Dutch puffer cheese. They're mini cakes with a little milk and flour and sugar and eggs, and they're awesome. And you can get a whole bag of 20 for a dollar.
Mm.
So you just walk around Chinatown and kind of munch those and get a cup of coffee to go with it.
And you're gonna send us those addresses, and we're going to put them up on our website so people can go.
Okay, I will. I will. I'll do it.
Heather, thank you for writing a great book, and thanks for coming on our show today.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
The book is Food Trucks, Dispatches, and Recipes from the Best Kitchens on Wheels. There are recipes in the book as well, and you can find out more about that at RestaurantGuysRadio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to us on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Mark and Francis, and you're listening to the Restaurant Guys.
Francis, you know what's really bad for a fat guy like me?
A lot. I mean, could you narrow that down?
Having an all-night, all-the-time set of 6 to 8, depending on the day, trucks who are armed only with a griddle and a fryer.
Yeah, yeah, that's bad.
Sitting across from where you reside and where you occasionally overindulge in the beverage department.
Back to the grease trucks. The food trucks at Rutgers are now all sort of corralled into a parking lot where they're basically stationary. But when we were in college, the trucks were actually
all along College Avenue,
parked all on two. They sort of gathered on two different areas, but the grease trucks were actually mobile, and they were on two different areas of College Avenue. And I remember that your dorm.
Yeah, it started. It's the year before I moved into the fraternity house. I lived in a dorm. I was an RA of a dorm. And it literally was outside, from my bedroom, from my bed,
you could
the
see
light of the grease truck would shine into my room. And that's not really good for a guy who likes to eat as much as I do.
Yeah, that was pretty, I don't know that I'm glad that wasn't outside my bedroom.
No, the 3 a.m. fried bagel run was not unprecedented.
Can I tell you something that we can put it out there, that Mark has never smoked pot in his life.
That's not a pot.
If you are, can you imagine?
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Have you ever did that?
I can't even imagine.
That?
Hey, listen, I lived in a fraternity house, and lots of guys there did. And, there'd be lines sometimes at the grease truck at 3:45 in the morning.
Yeah.
A line. Really?
You know, it reminds me of another truck that we used to call in a city I used to live in, not New Brunswick, and there was this ice cream truck. And it was a sort of a challenged neighborhood when I first moved there in 2000. And there was this ice cream truck in the neighborhood. And I don't want to name the particulars of it, but we used to hear the jingle of the Mr. Softy truck. And, you know, on weekdays, he'd be out there. And I wasn't near a park or anything. And he'd be out there until, I don't know, 11 o'clock at night, midnight. I'm like, what a crazy
Who's
city.
Who's getting Mr. Softy?
And it would stop, and people would come up to the truck and stuff. And I spoke to a friend of mine who's also in the food business, who's lived in this city for a long time and lived in the neighborhood as well. And I said, what's up with the 11 p.m. Mr. Softy? And he said, oh, Mr. Cracky? I'm so stupid.
Now that's a truck that could get some traction.
Yeah, there you go. Traction, I get it. And we ain't talking about the tires. Anyway, that's not there anymore, but that was a little bit scary. Anyway, well, I hope you've enjoyed the last hour with the Restaurant Guys. I know that we have certainly enjoyed the hour with you. I'm Francis Schock.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.